Is everybody ready for the last talk of the morning? I'm the third speaker in this session, and I'm artist Lucy Autor. And firstly, I'd like to thank all the team at the Johnson Museum for, first of all, bringing over our exhibition, Food, Water, Life, which is part of the Beyond Earth exhibition. You'll see that on the lower ground floor before descending down into the underground floor. Food, Water, Life. And I also thank everybody here for inviting me to this symposium to talk about my work. But I don't work individually. I work together with my husband, Jorge, who stayed behind in Paris to look after our children. And he's busy with the production of our next exhibition, which has the same title, Food, Water, Life, which will open in Paris on the 20th of May. And as many of the works are on show here, we have to make new work, which we're very excited about. So Jorge began his career in Argentina during the dictatorial regime in the 70s and early 80s, before moving to Paris in 1983. And I left England and began practicing an artist in Paris in 1992. And we created together Studio Autor, which is an umbrella structure for a large team of interdisciplinary artists, fabricators, and curators to develop and create an artistic format that are both representational and what we call operational aesthetics, which was a term that was coined by the art theorist Nicolas Boyau. In fact, it's aesthetic en fonctionnement in French, the functioning aesthetics. And we're motivated by four key questions. How can art pave a new critical role faced with the growing problems in the world? And how can it erase contradictions between formal aesthetics and social function? And how can artworks empower and nurture constructive dialogue? And what contribution can we as artists make to human and environmental sustainability? So our artwork has been widely exhibited in galleries and museums worldwide, but these public presentations represent just a fraction of our multifaceted studio production and communication processes. And we strive to create different formats that speak different visual languages within the context of the museum, the white cube, the intimacy of the home, or the playground of the public space interacting with a wider community. And we employ a huge diversity of mediums: drawing, print, embroidery, couture, welding, carpentry, silkscreen, installation, glassblowing, architecture, intervention. The list goes on. We're conscious that the vast array of resulting artifacts cannot just represent the complex and changing epoch. On the contrary, they should be active within people's lives, reactive to and act as trigger catalysts for solutions for society at large. Firstly, a little bit about my background. I was beginning to make a successful career in the Parisian couture houses, and the first Gulf War exploded, followed by the stock market crash and the consequences of the devastating economic recession. My encounter with Jorge in 1991 triggered my gradual transition away from fashion design into contemporary art, inspired by his work, an increasing need to become more socially active and find a new creative medium with which to express the effects of social instability around me. This is the first visual representation, manifestation of my work. It's called Refuge Wear. It was a dual response to the global crisis, the humanitarian aid appeals for shelter and clothing for the Kurd refugees fleeing the war zones, and the increasing numbers of homeless people on the streets of Paris. This first sculpture I realized was called the Habitent. It's a portable habitat designed for minimum comfort and personal refuge, an urgent mobility for nomadic populations. Habit, of course, implies a garment for meditation and a spiritual refuge, an inhabitant suggesting a human presence, an occupant for the dwelling. And the aluminum-coated one-person tent has a telescopic armature that transforms in a matter of seconds into a wind and waterproof poncho. Using my design expertise, I went on to explore further individual convertible shelters. The forms allow for the minimum vital space around the body. And the materials are chosen for their metaphoric properties. A combination of microporous ribstop with coated polyamide protects against abrasion, of course, during mobility, but at the same time takes into account the basic physical needs. Refugewear incorporates carbon armatures that raise the fabric above the chest to eliminate the effects of claustrophobia. And supporting structures are lightweight and telescopic, evoking pop-up architecture. These refugewear often have arm and hood appendages and convert into backpacks or pockets. And this transformation from shelter to clothing and vice versa is fundamental to the concept of freedom of movement, free will or choice, new relationships, new cultural exchanges. We're in the era of the new Homo mobilis. In 1993, I was invited to exhibit, at the Salvation Army shelter in Paris, designed by Le Corbusier, the City of Refuge. It was the 60th anniversary of the shelter. The exhibition was called Art, Social Function, and it marked the 60th anniversary. On one of the refuge where bivouacs suspended in the entrance hall of the hostel was a silkscreen printed text. It says, "Living without shelter for prolonged periods rapidly deteriorates physical and moral health. The lack of adequate sleep increases stress, weakens the immune system, and accelerates the loss of identity and desocialization." The artworks became the focal point for discussions with the residents. And so we created drop-in workshops with the hostel staff to channel their feelings through dialogue, drawing, and poetry. This led naturally to a series of refugewear trials, which resulted in confessions about the homeless experience and suggestions on how the precarious conditions could be ameliorated with numerous stopgap solutions. These emotional counters marked a change in my studio practice, as it became apparent that the workshops were more than just an artist offering a skill. A highly rewarding creative exchange and partnership could be nurtured between participant and artist, co-creation. And reiterating the words of the director of the Salvation Army, "I'm convinced today that in the launching of socialization, it is difficult to have access and go to art and culture. They must come towards our public. Culture must be included in the world of exclusion." Meeting urban philosopher Paul Virilio in 1994 was a significant turning point in my practice. His research at the time focused on the breakdown of the family unit and the necessity to reconstruct the social link. Quote, "The precarious nature of society is no longer of the unemployed or the abandoned, but that of individuals socially alone." The refugewear and survival kits I had been creating were concerned with the notion of individual survival, but it became more apparent that I should be investigating the role of the individual with a community structure, the collective body. Virilio's philosophy and social criticism encouraged me to explore new structures and processes for stimulating dialogue and interaction. I went on to create collective wear body architecture, exhibited here at the Modern Art Museum in 1994. The larger scale domes and collective tent structures seek to promote the opposite effect of the individual isolation units in the refuge wear series. This is body architecture for four people. And the surface skins of these architectures and enclosures have many facets and many appendages, demi-bodies that represent individuals within a community and at the same time evoke the complexities of shared space. In this study, it's body architecture Soweto. The external membranes of the tent structure is covered in secondhand clothes purchased from the community markets in Soweto townships in South Africa during a research trip for a commission for the second Johannesburg Biennial in 1997. Each individual keeps an eye on and protects the other. One individual's life depends on the life of the other. In Lucy's work, the warmth of one gives warmth to the other. The physical link weaves a social link. Virilio commented when I began first physically connecting people together. This body of work is called Nexus Architecture, and it's regarded as an emblem of my practice. Nexus means link or bond, and the symbolic content is more important than the functional. In this work, clothing becomes a medium through which social links and bonds are made manifest, both literally and metaphorically. The links of zippers and channels, while enhancing the uniformity of the workers' overalls, create androgynous shapes that defy classification by the usual social markers and attempt to give form to the social, not the individual body. The connecting elements are direct embodies of the social link, a social sculpture worn in public spaces and used for ephemeral interventions in contextual locations. During the interventions, performers and passers-by become physically involved in the construction of each scenario, which is filmed and photographed, climbing into the soups, zippering the nexus, walking and moving in unison, creating unusual closeness, questioning interdependence by being part of it, physical and visceral. The recurring public manifestations of the work create a poetic series of interrelated segments, regardless of religion, sex, age, or social status. The surface fabric of each nexus is adapted to context of each public intervention, silkscreen printed with inscriptions relating to current affairs. A segment of 16 suits created for the Venice Biennale were inscribed with newspaper headlines reporting the Rwanda genocide and worn by architecture students throughout the Biennale opening. And participating in the global march against child labor in 1998, teenagers from an orphanage I'd worked with communicated the UN Declaration for Children's Rights as they marched across France. And for the second Johannesburg Biennial, I chose to use traditional textiles from the colorful Dutch wax prints and African kangas purchased in South Africa. And this formed the basis for a community workshop with migrant female workers from a local city shelter in Johannesburg. The Nexus architecture experience produced some beautiful suits, but more importantly, it was a process of bringing forth the possibility of solidarity in a fractured environment where solidarity can be difficult to muster and maintain. And the Nexus architecture evolved from the linear configuration to a crisscross of connections, evocative of the molecular structure of atoms. Several hundred suits exist in this series, and in the city of Cholet, a city devastated by the closure of the children's clothing manufacturing plants, we staged a public intervention to coincide with a survey exhibition in the Museum of Fine Art. Over 100 children and their parents participated in workshops led by the museum to learn about the UN Declaration of Children's Rights. This is the Lifeguard series, and it has become one of my focus of my research as professor at London College of Fashion at the University of the Arts in London. An adaptation of the workers' overall block once again. It's used here as a starting point for a multitude of different assemblages to create both object-based and performative detournements. The extension of the garment incorporates Red Cross Army surplus articles. For example, the stretchers, like the ones you see here, they transform into connected figures, which are both supportive structures for the wearer and transportable aid devices for the bearer. These formed the central discourse of my exhibition at The Curve at the Barbican Art Gallery in London in 2005, comprised of 23 suspended stretcher beds incorporating over 60 figures. I reflected on the notion of the assistance and the assisted, whereby the body is not only understood as a measure of one's capacity to overcome or to support others in distress, but also as a fragile structure to be preserved. And portable protest is a response to the second Iraq invasion and builds upon work that George and I have been developing since the outbreak in 1991. It was commissioned by the Victoria and Albert Museum's late night performance evenings to be held on the 25th of June, just 5 days before the handover of sovereignty to the Iraqi government and the withdrawal of the US and the Allied forces. The independent NGO Project Iraq Body Count estimated that over 34,000 civilians were killed in Iraq in 2006 alone, and 1.8 million were driven from their homes, and over 2 million fled to other countries. What happens to all the people whose livelihoods, homes, and daily routines are permanently and irrevocably changed through violation of basic human rights in the name of Western democracy? Together with 50 volunteer performers, We staged a passive protest for peace, wearing the gold leaf printed combat suits. For over 2 hours, we silently meditate the future of Iraq and its citizens amongst the tomb and sepulchres and war trophies from historical battles and combats. Portable Protest concludes the first part of my presentation, and this is devoted to my research that explores clothing and my ambition to expand the definition and role that it plays within our society. I think you will agree that it touches upon the powerful communicative aspects of clothing, the role it plays in the construction of individual and collective identities, and how can we harness the power that clothing exerts on us through its extreme diversity and universality in ways which can alter our daily actions or perhaps even change society. And part two will focus on the areas of collaborative research that mark a shift away from the body to the global altruistic themes of human rights in the Project Antarctica, the Project Life, which is on exhibition here, and also to those of food and water scarcity explored in the themes of 70 by 7 The Meal and Water, also on exhibit upstairs. And one of our most recent bodies of work, Amazonia, which interrogates the importance of safeguarding our natural resources. I'll start with food. It's a project we called Horta Recycling, and it points a finger at food waste in the European cities. Yet it's also a reflection on the inequalities of food distribution globally. The work begins its life as an exhibition called All in One Basket, and an installation of artwork centered around an open-air buffet in the busy Les Halles market district of Paris, once a former fruit and vegetable market. We produced over 300 kilograms of food, discarded fruit and vegetables that we'd gleaned from the local markets. 300 kilograms we transformed into tasty samples, and we enlisted the help of the famous chef Stoher, who helped prepare and cook the produce into a variety of gourmet dishes, thereby re-civilizing this so-called abandoned food. Samples of jam, jellies, and puddings were available on small taster bowls for free. A number of those relics you can see in the exhibition upstairs. In the adjacent gallery of Saint-Eustache, we installed a collection of artifacts constructed from wooden fruit crates containing our homemade preserves, alongside photographs of mounds of discarded market produce. Visitors could buy souvenir editions of our bottled and labeled preserves, or listen to the personal stories in the form of audio recordings from the community of gleaners at the weekly markets. And those are the Walkmans integrated into the conservation units that you see upstairs. During the course of the opening, thousands of people, members of the art community, shoppers and children and tramps and students, joined us to discuss both art and food issues. 2 years later, we staged a second phase of Horta Recycling in Vienna, thanks to a commission from the Weiner Secession. And taking advantage of the proximity of the local fruit and vegetable Nashta market opposite the Viennese gallery, the energetic Secession curators helped us carry on the legacy of the Viennese manifesto, to every age its art and to art its freedom. After reflecting on the cycle of food recycling, we perfected our methods of collection, processing, and distribution to provide market vendors with brightly colorful collect units. These enabled a rapid and more hygienic gathering of produce instead of collecting it directly from the streets that we'd done in Paris previously. At the end of each market day, we fetched the bags using our specially fabricated processing units, the mobile kitchens, the one that you see upstairs, and pulley systems installed in the gallery. Thanks to these operational sculptures, with fully integrated sinks, hot plates, and freezers, we're able to clean, cook, bottle, and freeze the ripe food right on the spot, thereby putting in place a novelty recycling to be potentially adopted one day. Following the success of the social gatherings and the passionate discussions ensuing from the open-air buffets, we developed a third phase of these gastronomic works in the form of an unfolding series of meal performances that we called 70 by 7 The Meal. This participative body of work is inspired by Padre Rafael Garcia in Colombia. He initiated a series of benefit banquets called El Minuto de Dios to fundraise for a major urban social development program that would radically transform one of the most abandoned zones in the city of Bogota. The dinners were so successful that they raised enough funds to build a whole city, a district complete with community schools, homes and gardens, a theater, a contemporary art museum, small factories, and a university. We took the symbol 70 by 7, and it has its roots in the biblical signification, meaning ad infinitum. And it serves as a pretext to bring about multiple encounters between guests who are invited to dine in surprising installations and partake in an endless banquet. Seven guests invite seven others, etc., and so on. So the act of creating the meal happens through the chain reactions of human interaction. We are merely triggers or enablers in the process. 70 by 7 meal series is an invisible artwork. It takes the form of our most cherished of our rituals and mimics the essential need to eat and to unite. Only small signals like the limited edition porcelain plates and hand-printed tablecloth that we create for each event leave a trace that something unusual has brought these guests together. We hope that these clues will remain discreet so as not to incite the fear of art and allow the catalyst encounters to blossom naturally. Setting the meals in urban space is a return to the need for spontaneous general assemblies around specific subjects, bringing people to concert, to reconcile, to reflect together, with the potentiality of an artwork that is active within the community. The invisibility of the art renders the tool more effective by erasing the fear of not belonging to. This is one of our most successful of these community gatherings. It was our second, and it was staged in a small rural town, Dures, in the east of France. It has 3,000 inhabitants with a culturally divided population of Air Force servicemen, miners, farmers, immigrants, and unemployed. Commissioned by the local youth center in collaboration with seven local associate groups, we contacted every inhabitant in the town using word of mouth, press, radio, and door-to-door mailings to encourage the largest possible participation. We closed the main street and installed a half a kilometer table adorned with a red runner. Specially limited edition Royal Limoges plates were inscribed with the hopes and wishes of the inhabitants, which had been collected during the 18-month period prior to the event. His success was marked by the tremendous turnout, over half the population, and 750 porcelain plates were sold on that day. What started as an intimate dinner for seven members of the farming community in the Kunstram in Innsbruck has evolved today through 34 of these acts. 34 meals have taken place. This is the last of the meals to take place in Philadelphia in October last year. It was originally planned for the Independence National Historical Park, and you can see the table running along the mall here. Unfortunately, it was closed because of the government shutdown. But we moved the 900 guests to the Thomas Paine Plaza in front of the City Hall in Philadelphia. 900 people sat down at the table. Food organizations across the city were engaged in a discussion about the loss of biodiversity and the need to preserve heirloom species. 900 people sitting at the table, different community organizations, but we also sent meal kits out to other community organizations. In urban gardens, people were having meals. In the communities, people were cooking. And every single member of the community took home one of the plates to carry on the act of dining and discussing together. This is our 50th act. It hasn't taken place yet. And it covers several miles of the streets from the Tate Modern and runs across the Millennium Bridge to the Guildhall, the historical center in London. From our past experiences, we know it's possible to stage a meal of this size. It has 8,000 people sitting at the table. Each act of the meal has served as a forum for proposing new political, educational, social, environmental debates, as well as fundraising for social and environmental causes. Nobody can change the world with a meal, but each meal and their infinite accumulations have the potential to change a world, even if they are in a small way. Water. This body of work began its life as an exhibition project called Drink Water. It was commissioned by the Fondazione Bevilacqua La Massa, Bevilacqua means drink water, for the Venice Biennale in 2005. and which toured to the Museum Boijmans van Beuningen in Rotterdam in 2006. The initial premise was Venice, a city built on water and dependent on it for its livelihood, but more importantly, our research process and resulting artifacts were designed to focus our attention on the general scarcity of water and the issues surrounding the privatization and corporate control affecting access to clean water for all. Starting from an analysis of this critical issue through visual and textual research and international interdisciplinary workshops and seminars, we collectively brainstormed ideas for sculptures, large-scale installations, public works, and pilot projects that would both evoke the cycle of water and prompt ideas to design and implement clean water projects for communities in need. Catalogued in sketchbook format, the resulting drawings aim to pose questions through the surprising juxtaposition of handmade structures and the incorporation of functional found objects, referencing a wide range of water issues. We reflect on the cycles of water from the source to the pump, from the purification to the packaging and to the distribution. We created small urban vehicles, such as the Ape Piaggio, low-cost manpower distribution structures, water reservoirs, mobile fountains, Venetian-style transport trolleys, vitrines, boats, which oscillate between the metaphoric and the functional, the operational. The hundreds of low-cost water purification devices were discovered during our research were of particular significance. We went as far as incorporating fully functioning filtration systems into the sculptures. In this exhibition in Venice, we pumped the filthy Grand Canal water into the immaculate Venetian galleries through a filter circuit of connecting pipes in the artworks that you see here, and directly to the brass taps inserted in each of the objects. You could turn on the tap and simply demonstrate through the act of drinking that the filthiest waters in Europe is drinkable and available to taste to the thousands of visitors to the exhibition. Then, in Rotterdam, we pumped the Emmersinger Canal through the rear door of the museum in a network of pipes and bridges winding their way through the historical fine art galleries amongst the Van Eycks and the Bruegels into the exhibition space. Once again, the general public could just turn on the tap and take a drink. As the engineer we collaborated with demonstrated, it's not rocket science. One of our dilemmas was how to incite people to drink the filthy water and partake emotionally in the experience of this transformation. If it were in a bottle, would it please you more? So we drew on the bottled water product of our market system to create the limited edition artwork, Auto Water, clean water bottled at source from canals and available for general public to take away. As in all of our projects, we undertake a research process of a minimum 10 years, and we continue to work with engineers on tackling all kinds of water polluted sources. Here is our installation at the Shanghai Biennial in 2012. It's on the fourth floor, 20 meters up, so that's five floors. Down below is the Huangpu River, one of the most polluted rivers in China. We pumped it up into the gallery through the system of pipes and purified it and once again distributed it to the visitors of the biennial, 2012. And our next exhibition in Paris, we'll be pumping the Canal de l'Ourcq, which was the original drinking water system for Paris, which has now become a transport canal. Completely polluted, we're pumping it into the gallery, we're purifying it to distribute it out to visitors once again in May. Life, the final chapter of the exhibition upstairs. As part of Jorge's project for his representation at the 1995 Venice Biennale, he represented Argentina, they didn't have a pavilion, so we hired a canal boat. We presented a draft proposal for the Antarctica World Nationality and the idea for a new utopia in a project that became known as Antarctic Village, No Borders. This idea focuses on the only unclaimed landmass on Earth, Antarctica, which is governed by the treaty, originally signed by 12 countries in 1959, today counts 50 signatory nations. The peace treaty was the first arms control agreement established during the Cold War and is declared the sixth continent a scientific preserve. establishing the freedom for scientific investigation, an environmental protection zone, and a ban on all military activity. Antarctica is a unique, peaceful territory to which we can all aspire. And the Antarctic Village represents a place of welcome for us, for those fleeing the countries to escape political, social conflict, or an environmental catastrophes, a physical embodiment of Marshall McLuhan's global village. In 2006, we began producing a temporary encampment of over 50 domed-shaped dwellings, reflecting qualities of nomadic shelters and temporary campsites. The dome dwelling components were assembled in our studio and hand-stitched together by a traditional tent maker with sections of flags from countries around the world, along with the extensions of clothes and gloves symbolizing the multiplicity and diversity of people. The flags and the fragments of clothing are silkscreen printed with motifs proposing a new article for the UN Declaration of Human Rights, Article 13.3, No Borders. This mobile village is a symbol of the plight of those struggling to gain freedom of movement. And when the End of the World Biennial approached us in 2007, we showed them these renders. We tried to imagine what our global village might look like in Antarctica. The curators were suitably impressed, so they embarked our team on an incredible expedition to Antarctica to found the first Antarctic village. And when we arrived at the Morambio Antarctic base, the scientists were not at all impressed. So how do you get scientists involved in art? Soccer. The team's jerseys were stitched together using different nations' colors, front and back. The speed of the game on the ice pack, the sub-zero temperatures, and the variety of play and action made it difficult to identify which players were allies and which were adversaries. The match was a true role reversal where only actions themselves count and not appearance. And coincidentally, just 100 years earlier, the stranded Antarctic Shackleton expedition team, one of the most famous expeditions conducted by the explorer Shackleton, he and his 28 men also played football on the ice. And one of the phrases that I've written down from his expedition, difficulties are just things to overcome after all. At the end of the austral summer, during the months of February, March, we were physically able to install the village in Antarctica, traveling from Buenos Aires aboard the Hercules KC-130 flight on this incredible journey, aided by the logistical crew and scientists stationed at the Morambio base. The ephemeral installation of the first village was finally realized at four locations across the continent after 12 years research and development. Here are some of the images from that installation. And on our return back to Europe, we exhibited the dwellings in an important touring survey show at the Hangar Bicocca Contemporary Art Space in Milan in Italy, and created many more artworks in the Antarctica series. The drop parachutes are an extension of my earlier survival kits. They resemble mini drop parachutes using fragments of the textiles left over from the domes. As in many other works, we find an explicit reference to the tools and objects of emergency rescue missions. In this case, the model is a kind of parachute used by humanitarian expeditions to rapidly distribute vital supplies. These are the lifeline, the life jackets, the lifesavers, the life preservers, referring to both physical material rescue and symbolically to the spiritual needs of man. Employing materials such as steel, textile, silkscreen print, and assemblage, the combination of found utilitarian or personal objects suspended from the handcrafted steel frames reference the recovery of a lost social dimension, such as affection or solidarity. And no country is complete without its identity document. So we've imagined the Antarctica World Passport that can be delivered from the passport delivery bureaus. The bureaus are constructed from makeshift furniture and supplies that we collect along our journeys. And a passport is distributed during exhibitions or special events that aim to raise awareness of issues affecting international freer migration. The 1948 Declaration of Human Rights, Article 13, currently states the inherent dignity of every member of the human race and the equal and inalienable rights constitutes the fundamental liberty, justice, and peace in the world. However, it does not mention the freedom to move or to cross borders. If we were to amend this article, we could take into consideration the rights of hundreds of millions of men and women hunted from their native lands by economic ruin, war, or political intimidation. And the passport serves as a testimony to this reflection. And here within, we find a new article to perhaps be adopted one day, Article 13.3. Everybody has the right to move freely and circulate beyond the state borders to a territory of their choice. No individual should have an inferior status to that of capital, merchandise, communication, or pollution that traverse all borders. Here is our first signing up for the passports in 2008. An edition of 10,000 passports were printed for the Hanyabikoka exhibition. We write down the names, and the number is given to each of our citizens. Further distribution bureaus in Athens for the Biennale, and then at the Natural History Museum in Paris. And here, again, for the Shanghai Biennial, when we were literally mobbed and had to close down the bureau. So, what do we do with all of these citizens? Well, up here, this is the passport edition, and please go and collect your passports after this presentation. We have the object, and we have the citizens. In the beginning, as you can see, we're doing it in a very analog way. So over the last 6 years, I've been developing a website. We began working on it with MIT, and the first prototype came out in 2011. And now what we're doing is inviting participants to sign up through the website to collect their passport. But the potentiality of this database, this citizen database, could be harnessed in other ways. So this is what we're reflecting on at the moment. How can we get our citizens to participate in environment aid, in social progress aid, in migration aid, in water aid, in survival aid, in habitat aid, all of these themes which encompass our Project Antarctica? Of course, there's a Facebook page, but it's not enough. So the next phase of the www.antarcticaworldpassport.com is to bring all of these citizens to action. And you can see here the map that's beginning to be created. Our early passport holders are not on this map because we didn't take their email addresses, which was very stupid of us. But we asked today, I request my passport to act in favor of sustainable development through simple daily acts, defend natural environments under threat as global public resources, fight against climate change generated by human activity, support humanitarian actions, aiding displaced peoples in the world, share values of peace and equality, impart this charter to future generations. So if you sign up for your passport, please sign the charter. And a very nice motto from the End of the World Biennial is, dreaming at the end of the world is another world possible. Of course, we believe it is. And I'll take you through one of our projects, which is not on exhibit here, that we're currently working on. And it's called Amazonia. We had an exhibition at the Natural History Museum in 2010, the International Year of Biodiversity. And we asked the Natural History Museum whether it would be possible to go on an expedition to actually witness the loss of biodiversity ourselves. And as it so happened, the Cape Farewell organization that you might have heard of that organizes trips to the Antarctic to investigate climate change together with artists and scientists organized the first trip to the Amazon. So we journeyed to the Amazon to experience the immensity and grandeur of such a vulnerable living organism. And we hoped that by gaining insight, the artworks that we would create out of this experience, the artworks that we were creating for the Natural History Museum exhibition, could allow nature to invade our emotions and minds once again. For those of you who don't know the Kate Fairwell organization, it's a non-profit body dedicated to communicating the effects of climate change through art science collaborations. And we traveled with a group of artists and scientists from the Environmental Change Institute at Oxford University. It was a 4-week journey that took us up 15,000 feet up to the Glacier Salsante and down 11,000 feet to the cloud forest and tree line and the science station of Waiketcha. And then we went down the Andes, 1,000 meters along the Trocha Union, the infamous Inca path through the rainforest to the Amazon basin, to the tributary river, the Madre de Dios. We navigated a 270-mile stretch of the Amazon forest, stopping in science stations in the Mano Biosphere Reserve, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, where the highest rate of biodiversity in the world is recorded, to our final departure at Puerto Maldonado. As part of the research, we participated in various scientific data collection research programs, and at the same time recorded this beautiful oasis of diversity through photography, video, and sound. The Mano region proved to become an emotional conceptual starting point for the new works on exhibition at the Natural History Museum. And on our return to Paris, we began by imagining an installation composed of three-dimensional and two-dimensional works, as well as audio and film. The Drawings Amazonia Expedition sketchbook are a reflection on our first impressions of and responses to the journey. The works on paper conceptualize the experience of the Amazon and the understanding of the connections between us and the natural environment. We are part of nature, and the iconography in the drawings playfully depicts this mutual dependency. But in fact, we are more dependent on nature than nature is on us. Our presence brings about nature's decline and humans' decline with it. Unless we choose to change and find solutions to these local and global problems by placing us within nature, not outside of it. This is our Madre de Dios fluvial unit. There are little animals, we don't see them very well here, pairs of creatures in this Noah's Ark construction. And the creatures are standing on a mirror surface. And when you approach the boat, you look down to the animals, but you see yourself reflected in them. Of course, man is the only person not on that boat, but he is himself reflected in that mirror surface. Life on our planet is in constant flux, as we know, and there's been life on Earth for 3.5 billion years. Since then, there have been 5 mass extinctions, and extinctions are a natural part of life. But the current rate of loss is about 100 to 1,000 times what it should be. And this decline, as we know, is the 6th mass extinction. And its distinguishing characteristic is caused by humans. Using this as a starting point and drawing from collaborations with researchers in the paleontology department of the Natural History Museum, we took casts of fossilized dinosaur bones from the museum's collection and created these giant aluminium bones here. Despite the colorful iridescent finish, they remain relics of death, a reminder of the many forms of life that have been shaped through evolution, giving us a tangible sense of the contemporary of times past. In contrast, we also made these delicate sculptures out of fragile porcelain cast from specimens in the museum's collection, and we inscribed them with tiny fragments of life, the egg from the elephant bird, the limb bone from the dinosaur Galliminus and Allosaurus, the elephant ancestor, Palaestomerodon. Bones are memento mori, reminders of death, but the egg is birth, the start of life. The flowers, butterflies, and insects that populate these works point to the cycle of life and then beauty and wealth on our planet. Seeing ourselves as occupying a moment in time through the reflection on the mirrored surface of these glass plinths allows us to question our arrogance over nature and the need to work with it rather than against it. As we'd spent such a lot of time in the Mano Biosphere Reserve, this became an important focus for photographic work we called Perpetual Amazonia. And partaking in the scientific research, we mapped out a 1-hectare plot of the rainforest and recorded the plant specimens the height and the diameter of trees that are monitored for the purposes of ecological and climate research. We captured in photography every flower we encountered, enhancing the hidden details such as the stamen and pistil, the seed pod, the crushed petals, or the minuscule insect, and continued this photographic methodology during our travels elsewhere, adding to a gigantic database of plant specimens from around the world. Back in the studio, we edited a series of images to which the GPS coordinates in the title of the work and on each photograph refer. We then divided the hectare into 10,000 subplots. These are some of the calculations that the scientists helped us with, each marked with its plot reference, the UTM coordinate, denoting the exact location of the meter square plot in the Amazon. Each of these photographs is for sale, and it's accompanied by a 60-year certificate of moral ownership, decreeing the rights to protect the plot and its biodiversity, to contribute to the research, and at the same time, an obligation to pass on the accumulated knowledge to a second generation. The artwork poses many complex questions about ownership, indigenous land rights, and the common rights of this natural heritage. We know that land is being expropriated or compulsory purchased from indigenous populations for exploitation of natural resources, and we all know the effects of this daily devastation. In the past 50 years, a third of the world's rainforest has been felled and burned. And the UN Convention on Biological Diversity states in the last 8,000 years, about 45% of the Earth's original forest cover has disappeared, clearly mostly during the past century. And as Wilson so eloquently states, destroying the rainforest for economic gain is like burning a Renaissance painting to cook chips, French fries. It was not possible for us to sell the photographs in the Natural History Museum, so we proposed a public engagement project for the visitors who were invited to take a perpetual Amazonia poster and in exchange make a contribution to preserve the into perpetuity the meter square plot it represents, and by doing so become a steward of the Amazon rainforest. The posters are an extension of the notion of relational aesthetics. They are freely acquired, yet engage in active participation. At the same time, we prompt the audience to reflect on how we value a hectare of forest. Because the loss of nature has a price? Is it how it makes us feel emotionally? By how much wealth it produces? Or the well-being it brings to indigenous peoples? By its influence on global climate? So what price are we willing to pay? With over 41,000 people visiting the Natural History Museum exhibition, we distributed over 8,000 posters. And we raised just under $10,000 for research in the Amazon. Even we were surprised with the achievement, and this emulates the theory of operational aesthetics. Amazonia has marked an important transition in our practice, which is not only aesthetic, it's become a state of mind through which we strive to revive our deep enjoyment of nature and to convey its value to our daily lives and to our survival. I'll end the presentation to show you one of the projects which we're working on, which is our life project. At the top, La Laiterie, which is a dairy, the dairy. That's our studio. It's 30 miles from Paris, 15 miles from the international train station, 15 miles from Disneyland, Euro Disney, and 30 miles from the international airports. And the dairy, former dairy, it's the Brie region, the cheese district. It's a very pastoral region. And along the river, there are a number of factories. The Moulin de Vacherie is a mill, formerly a grain mill. The Moulin de Boissy, a pulp mill, paper pulp mill. And Moulin Sainte-Marie was the location of the fabrication of the Rive d'Arche rag paper. So the rag pulp was transported downriver to the Moulin Sainte-Marie. We're undergoing a process of purchasing these mills, the factories, the former factories along the river, because further upriver, the local council has knocked them down, and they no longer exist. So one of our projects is to restore the heritage, the industrial heritage, through contemporary art. We started with our studio. We then got hold of the Moulin de Boissy, and this is our studio, the dairy. It's a picture from the 1930s. You can see that's not our car. And this is our team working in the studio. As you can see, we are very hands-on. We make a lot of our objects, we assemble them, we finish them in the studio. We're working on the exhibition Clouds, which was an exhibition that we had in 2012 in Versailles. And you might remember there were clouds also in the International St. Pancras Eurostar Station. Last year we won a competition for the work to be suspended in the International Train Station. And the Moulin de Boissy has now become a contemporary art gallery. We gave the space to an international art gallery who are organizing exhibitions. You can see where it's situated in relation to Paris and the airports, going east towards Nancy. And their first exhibition they held in 2007. Here is the location. So we've now restored this, and it is a functioning, fantastic international exhibition venue. And we're in the process of restoring the Moulin Sainte-Marie, so that's the fourth mill along the river, the former Papeterie de Paris, so the former paper industry in France. And here on the island is the original rag paper production site here, handmade paper. And then all of this are the larger industrial machines that were built in the 1700s, 1800s. And some of our ideas for the project, artist studios, center for the water and the environment here on the river. There's a weir that runs across here, and offices in the former office block, music and performance. We have a sewage plant here, which is now empty, a foundation, gallery spaces, there's potential for building, and here is the restaurant cafeteria, which we call the Maison des Artistes, the artist's home, the artist's house. And we have all of this land here and the river running along that for projects. And some of the renovations that have been undergoing, so we're putting in light so that we begin to work here. We don't have any electricity at the moment, so that's going in. And this no longer works. It was a former electricity turbine. And here was the packing and sewage plant. And some of the spaces that we've cleaned out. And these will become the artist residences, and they back out onto the river here. The Maison des Artistes, the cafeteria, and the offices.